Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge is back. Silent Phil, as always, is with us. Sherry, it's great to have you back after a week. Had a lot of fun with Burl co-hosting. But it's always great to have you back.
I love hearing you guys together, but you know, I don't want to be replaced.
I'm recording, as our listeners know, we've been recording this now via a conference call for the last few weeks as we social distance. But I am actually recording this sitting in my car out in front of my house. And why? Because it's the only quiet place I could find in my house or around my house, because my house with a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old is insane. And it's a pretty small house and it's hard to get away from the craziness. So
I'm in the guest room again.
I don't hear Charlie Coolidge barking. So
no, I think Charlie is in the Coolidge COVID school today. That's going on in Jack's bedroom.
Okay. Sherry,
Coolidge COVID school does have a catchy ring to it, doesn't it? But I can't wait until we go back to school, even if it's next year. But oh my goodness.
Yes, Sherry's son Jack, is he sixth grade?
He's in fifth grade.
Fifth grade, okay. So he goes to middle school next year, huh?
He does. And so
next thing you know, Sherry, he's gonna be driving, tearing up the roads all across Greater Cincinnati.
I don't even want to think about that. We can't even leave the house right now, so we'll put that off for a little bit.
Welcome back from a week off, and you come back and still lots of coronavirus news.
That's right. I mean, I definitely, kept up with everything and read everything. I would say might be slightly tan. I'm rested. I went on bike rides every day. Nice. It was a nice little break.
Yeah, no, that's good. Our special guest today, before we jump into the Sherry Coolidge and my portion of the show, our special guest today is Director of Elections for the Hamilton County Board of Elections, Sherry Poland, here to talk everything and anything about what probably is the craziest election we're ever going to have in our lifetime. And really looking forward to having Sherry Poland join us to discuss. I mean, I think a lot of people still have questions about this. And
definitely. And we talked about it 2 episodes ago, the craziness of the day that really switched everything.
Yep.
From an actual election day to what we're going to be doing here. And we'll let her, kind of put it in her own words, I think. But I will say the last time I talked to Sherry was that Monday, the 16th, briefly in the morning, there was a directive that the Board of Elections were to have curbside voting. And when I saw that, I was like, what?
Yeah.
And so I texted her. So that was our last conversation. I was like, are you having curbside voting? And she's like, I don't think it's going to work that way.
Well,
and it hasn't.
So we're looking forward to having her, because I just to do a Q&A of so many questions you and I have, Sherry, about this election. And honestly, now there's talk about, as we look toward the fall, and maybe is some of this stuff going to carry over in terms of the process into November. And I know they're talking about it in Washington. The country is now starting to talk about, are we going to have a vote by mail election in November? So look forward to having Sherry on to ask her about that, and about obviously with April 28th approaching and the end of the longest primary, I would think, in the history of Ohio. I guess I haven't really gone back and looked.
But I mean, we've ever had technically the longest period. Because we had early voting too before this even all started.
Correct. That's what I meant. Longest election period where we've had May primaries before in Ohio. Obviously, they used to have the city mayor's primary in May. But anyway, before we jump to over to Sherry Poland, let's talk about the news at hand, Sherry. And I wrote a column for last week that I talked about shared services, that with the city and the county being in dire straits right now with their budgets, that you would think, if not now, when? There's been so much talk over so many years, so many studies, so many task force, so many committees, so much lip service. And the reason why I really wanted to talk more about this, Sherry, is because nobody knows this better than you, having been both the Inquirer's Hamilton County beat reporter and now as our City Hall watchdog. So you've seen, you've been on the inside of both the county and the city for several years, and you've written many, many stories about this issue. Talk about that, and I guess maybe just talk about a little bit about the history of you covering it and whether you've ever thought it was ever a serious conversation.
Well, I have to say it definitely was a serious conversation, although yeah. I never really could see it happening. But Todd Fortun, longtime commissioner, right? Like this was a passion of his and early on. So I covered the commission from 2010 to 2014. And during that time, there was the charter review. No, that was the city one. Hold on. There's so many these studies. Yeah. And every time we do a study, they promise they won't sit on the shelf and gather dust. Yep. But here we are. So this was the, remind me of the name, you just wrote about it.
Remind of the, of what, the specific task force?
Yeah, well, there was a task force looking at, you know, really doing a combination. And it was very intense and granular of all the little fire districts and the police departments and the city and the county.
Yep.
And, you know, we saw other cities manage to go to these metro-type governments. And we just, it's a power struggle. You know, everything that can be written in the reports doesn't get to that outlier of the power struggle. So I have recently, you know, like in the last year, been thinking about it again, just in the idea that now is, if we were ever going to do it, now is a good time. Because, you know, the mayor is term limited out. Six council members are term limited out. And so that kind of sets up an election that could be this more metro type government without anyone having to cede, you know, all of the work they've put in or the things they're working on in council, trying to run for reelection. And like, it is a setup. And now here we are in honestly this absolute budget crisis of how things are funded. And you just cannot look at all of the governments that we have in the different funding streams and not think a combination of those funding streams needs another look.
Absolutely. And you talk about the city facing potentially $80 million, I mean, just unprecedented $80 million deficit here in the upcoming fiscal year, which for the city is July 1. So that's coming up. And then in the immediacy, they're also facing, what, a $27 million deficit in the next few months. So that's over. I think we've gone over this before. Journalist math says that's $107 million. And then on the county side, the commissioner has called for 20% across the board cuts in every department. When you start to look at the list of departments in the county, that's a lot of cuts. And they're saying that, I saw something where they're saying that the sales tax could take as much as a 70% hit. And the county obviously relies both on sales tax and property tax. And because of that, it's not in as bad a shape as the city. But nonetheless, you're talking about scary, unprecedented budget cuts that I don't think we've ever seen, certainly in the modern day.
Well, and just the idea of being able to just not recreate the wheel. I mean, the two health departments, the two prosecutors' offices. And again, this does seem like a good time to really look at these things. But also, I mean, obviously this is not going to be easy, but I mean, we have all the time in the world, like the future into perpetuity. Like sometimes, you know, hard decisions need to be made.
Well, I think now too, Sherry, and you're right about the timing. I mean, the pandemic, you know, if not now, when? But then you also factor in, you know, when you're telling me about all those years of covering the county, when you were covering the county, it was controlled by Republicans. So you had Republican control in the county and you have Democratic control in City Hall. But now that's completely not the case. You have full Democratic control on the county Board of Commissioners, and you have full Democratic control majority at City Hall. And so to me, you brought up John Cranley. I also think Denise Driehaus, obviously there's no term limits as a commissioner, but if there's someone who's going to do this, or some people who are going to do this, I think John Cranley and Denise Driehaus are the perfect people to really tackle this, you know, given their experience. You know, they've had their differences over the banks and over MSD, but gosh, like, I mean, these are two veteran politicos around here who have entrenched names, who have known each other for so long. You would really like to see them come together on this and tackle it, and certainly with the support of all several of the council and other commissioners and other elected officials, and both Republican and Democrat, the business community, labor. You start to bring in even, you know, more of those folks kind of around the movers and shakers on 4th Street, and you know, eventually, if you can get everyone around the table, and then obviously you start to bring in the folks in Lachlan and Redding and Wyoming and Marymount and Delhi Township and Greentown. And so, but to me, it's got to be done very methodically. It's, you know, Greg Landsman, the councilman, is working on trying to take some of those baby steps right now, where, you know, to me,
you know what, though, to make this work, even at the very beginning, he needs a partner at the county. It has to be somebody, you know, at the county level that agrees with him. And you have to have a partner to, you know, not hold hands in a pandemic, but to walk forward together in presenting this with two voices, respective voices. And, you know, I'll be interested to see. I mean, your column did just post this morning. Interested to see if it really kind of starts this conversation again.
Yeah.
I mean, the policing aspect of things, I mean, these silos of these different things, they really hurt us, especially in like a pandemic where everyone isn't working together. And if you need these backups, it all becomes harder because there's different jurisdictions and how these things work. And, you know, we need to act like a region.
Amen
to that. That we are.
Did you ever feel like in your time of covering the county, and it, remind listeners of what years you were on that beat?
2010 to 2014.
So 2010 to 2014. And then since 2014, wow, has it been 6 years on the City Hall beat?
Yeah, remember what we say about that, dog years? They're like dog years. I wouldn't have it any other way, though. It's you know what? It's the news. It's important news. And you know, when you cover a beat, this is true of any reporter and anyone. The more you go along, the more you learn about things and, you know, understanding the budgets and the granular parts of it. And honestly, the county budget, too. And like then how that works. And I had people in both the county and the city who were very kind to me and taught me the ins and outs of the budget. And I'll tell you what, when I used to look at the stadium sales tax spreadsheet, I was like, yeah, I'll never understand that. Yeah. And Christian Sigmund, a former county administrator, countless hours, I'm pretty sure, teaching me to understand how that money flows and like the bonding of the stadiums and everything. And it has served me well, like covering the banks and understanding what happens. And so, yeah, that experience is helpful. But if everyone had that, right, and understood each other's money and budgets, it would help, like, with decision-making, I think.
Absolutely. Especially,
even if we're not going to talk about a metro government now, I'll be interested to see if some of these conversations do revive. Maybe the prosecutor's office and the idea of saving money, which that was always mentioned. That was always the reason to talk about that. And that's come up many times outside of like a giant change, or these health departments are going to need a lot more money. And right now there's an acting director at the county health department.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, you know, what could that look like together? And not an idea of saving money, in an idea of saving lives and that's making right. sure those funding streams are really what they need to be, instead of like, you know, two different governments. Honestly, they're like six blocks away from each other,
yep.
where they're all working, trying, you know, to cobble it together. And like, this would be the time to really look at that. And so that would be done for those reasons.
Yeah, no, and I tend to think of these things that if there's not a real big pushback or a lot of noise made by either A, just the general taxpayers and voters, or B, you know, influential group or groups, you know, for example, the business community. A lot of times, you know, you fear that some of these things can fall on deaf ears and people will. I mean, I've already gotten with the column, you know, hey, oh, this has been done, never going to happen. And I'm like, that's exactly what I'm trying to say here. What you hope doesn't happen is like, no, these are different times. And there's a lot of uncertainty that we're expecting here in the next several months and probably several years, maybe even. I mean, life is going to be different coming out of this pandemic. And I don't know what, you know, you got to dig deeper into it and figure out like how dire is this long term for the city and the county. And so then therefore, do they both need to turn around and say, you know, and I'm not, do they both need to turn around and say, yeah, two prosecutor's office just isn't feasible anymore, two 911 centers or two environmental offices and I mean, so two parks, you know, departments. And so to me, you consolidate one of those or two of those. And to me, I think those are big wins along the way here. And then you start to get some of those wins and the city and the county and the politicos and the voters and the taxpayers, they like it. And eventually maybe you get to that point where you go for that so-called Unigov or Metro government, but let's not go from 0 to 60. Right out of the gate here, and you know, I mean, baby steps.
That we're so separate when it comes to getting federal stimulus money. You know, one of the big things, and there will be money flowing from the state. So this is from the state,
yeah,
into cities, and so this is all very different. But there's direct money for Columbus, this large area of more than 500,000 people. Well, we're more than 500,000 people. We're just two governments, and so, you know, one is smaller than the other, and it needs to, like, that's when you flex your muscles. It's like, yep. We're a big region, and we're, you know, the third, you know, largest region in the state, and you go that way in trying to get things done and help from these, you know, state and federal government.
That's right. The question I was going to ask you was, do you ever feel like in all your times of writing about this, did you ever feel like the city and the county were ever really close on
no.
combining services, on, you know, just even one department or one?
No, never one
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
And we, you know, there used to be like shared services committees and everything, even out of like, you know, that bigger thing. I never saw anything come out of them. I'm sorry. You know, people would yep. say, oh, shared services. And, you know, after a while, it was just, you know, the same old, and I was like, this is never happening.
Well, your eyes.
I think they once counted all the fire hydrants together, and that was like the big win. And I was like, that is not yes. what this was supposed to be
that's,
about.
That's right. Well, I have brought that up when I've mentioned shared services before. That has been brought up to me about how well the county helps. I don't know, some of these little village, like little towns around the county, helps them in upkeep with their fire hydrants. I'm like, yeah, that's good, but that's not really what we're talking about here.
So yeah, I mean, and even when you would be writing about it, people would just, you know, say, you know, off the record. No, 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 no. That's not going to work. And you felt the resistance.
Yeah.
And so it is time to have that conversation again. I don't know what that's going to look like. And also, it is a time of like trying to figure out how these meetings are going to be public and have meetings all the time. And like,
yeah.
So people are kind of struggling through that too. And I hope that doesn't stop conversations from happening because you don't, you know, have meetings and talk about ideas because, you know, you have to social distance and you're afraid. And I hope we somehow, you know, kind of get back to the idea of, you know, that's where these conversations need to happen at committees and the staff working meeting at the county. And
well, I mean, you know, here's the question. People may roll their eyes right now just at this thought of bringing it up. And kudos to Greg Landsman for at least just broaching the topic and the Cincinnati Chamber and Cincinnati Business Committee for putting this this group together to look at restarting the economy. And as a part of that, they're wanting to broach the subject about shared services with local governments. But what I wonder is, are they really going to, as we go along here, are they even going to really have a choice? They're already making unprecedented cuts. And so are they really going to have a choice at some point, you know, but not to look at this?
I don't know what the answer is to that.
Yeah.
Because when you are the city manager or you are the county administrator, the direction isn't to be like, you know, first of all, you're making decisions very quickly at this point to try and close, you know, shortfalls in budgets that are happening at this moment.
Yep.
And your directive is to look at the work that's immediately in front of you, which is the county budget and the city budget. Nobody's saying, well, in a very fast moving scenario, well, what if it was this?
Yeah.
like that's a very hard thing. So maybe a conversation over the next year as we head into like new budgets over that time coming up. I don't know though.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, something tells me that we'll be talking about this again at some point, whether it's that they didn't do it or and let's be honest, I think it's going to take nothing short of a miracle probably for it to get really, really serious. And I'm not just saying talk about it and form another task force and all that. I'm actually saying actually doing something. But one way or the other, I think we're all going to be discussing this and writing more stories about it and having more podcasts about this issue as the economy is uncertain moving forward.
Especially on the city side with how things are funded.
Exactly. With the income and earnings tax. So let's shift gears and let's jump to Hamilton County Director of Elections with the Board of Elections, Sherry Poland. Well, special guest time here on the That's Just Cincinnati podcast. I'm pleased to welcome in from her busy schedule right now in this crazy, wild election, the Director of Elections for the Hamilton County Board of Elections, Sherry Poland. Sherry, thanks so much for taking some time with us here, you know, out of your busy schedule.
Oh, absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Let's jump right to it. I mean, Sherry, have you, you know, just general question. Is this the craziest thing in all of your career? And you've been with the Board of Elections since 2004 and several years prior to that working in the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. But in all your time of working around elections, have you ever seen anything that anywhere close to this?
I have not. We have overcome a lot of obstacles over the years, but this one sort of you know, tops them all. This has been challenging, but I'm also happy to say that our team here at the Board of Elections, we are rising to the occasion.
As expected, Sherry Coolidge and I were talking about this. You know, if I can brag about, you know, your team is just top notch, and the transparency. And I'm just speaking from my own standpoint. Is that anytime I've ever asked folks for documents or data, yourself, Dave, Deb, there's so many folks there that, I mean, this is a team that is just so on it and so passionate about, you know, fair and open and transparency. And I can't commend you and your team enough for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'll definitely share that sentiment with them. Obviously, transparency is of utmost importance to us because we want people to have confidence and faith in the election and their results. And providing those public records requests timely is a big part of that.
Well, I mean, speaking of, just kind of dovetailing off of that, in this unprecedented, and we'll jump around here a little bit, but in this unprecedented election that's now only vote by mail, what mechanisms and things are in place to be above board and try to avoid any type of election fraud or any?
Right. Well, you know, as you know, in Ohio, we have 28 days of early voting prior to Election Day. And mm-hmm. that's not only in-person voting, but also by mail voting. So we already have very strict guidelines set up. And basically, these are uniform guidelines that come from the Secretary of State to ensure the security and accuracy of early voting. So for us, that's just been extended for another month with all the different steps that we follow in verifying the ballots that have been submitted to the Board of Elections and sort of going through that whole security process. So we basically just extended that process another month, albeit a much higher volume. But you know, we do have that plan in place, and it's been in place for, I think we've had no-fault absentee voting for over a decade in Ohio.
So without getting too far in the weeds, let's say, you know, someone sends their ballot in, they mail it in, in an envelope, and then at that point, when it gets to your office and it's time to open that, like who's opening it and who's around to see it being opened, and you know, where does it go from there?
And sure. What precautions are taken when touching it?
Sure. So I'll start with that one. As far as the precautions we're taking here at the Board of Elections, luckily we have, you know, this new facility in Norwood that we moved to back in 2017. So we have plenty of space. So all of our staff that are currently working here are, you know, keeping their social distance. They're at least 6 feet apart at their workstations. We have a supply of hand sanitizer and disinfecting wipes because our intention was to send that to the polling locations on March 17th. When that didn't happen, now we have a supply for all of our workers. They also are using gloves, masks. They're taking their temperatures before they come to work. And then so they're using all of those materials and supplies when they open the mail daily. As far as the security of the vote, when a ballot by mail arrives back at the Board of Elections, it's contained inside what we call an identification envelope, and mm-hmm. it has identifying information for that voter. So their name, their address, a form of ID, and their signature, and an image of that identification envelope is scanned through a system we have, and our bipartisan election officials compare the information contained on that envelope to the information in our voter registration system. And it has to be a match. So we're not only ensuring, of course, the voter had to be registered before we even would send a ballot to them, and a similar process is gone through when we receive an application before we even mail the ballot. Then when the ballot comes back, it's again reviewed for that information before the ballot is opened and removed from the envelope.
How long does that take?
Well, it depends on the amount of ballots that we receive in a day, but we do we keep up with this every day. Whatever ballots we receive in the mail go through that process the same day it's received, and the ballots opened. And it just depends on what, as far as how long. How many ballots we receive. It could take an hour. It could take several hours. Our staff's currently working 11 to 12 hours a day. So we, you know, we're processing those and keeping up with those every day.
Are you able to process basically everything that comes in during the day? The day is kind of based on that, or do you just kind of have to end at a certain point? You're like, well, we'll get to the rest of it tomorrow.
It sort of depends on where we are in the cycle. Right now, what we're receiving the most of is the applications from voters, the applications that have to be submitted to the board in order to receive a ballot. And from the time we receive that application to the time the ballot is placed in the mail, right now we're on about a two-day turnaround, 2 to 3 days at the most. So I think that's good right now. We obviously need to narrow that down to same day by the time we get closer to April 24th, April 25th. I sort of look at it as our own version of flattening the curve for us in elections. We're making sure that we stay on top of all of these processes so that it never gets to a amount that's unmanageable for us. So that's why we've brought in extra staff. We've working the long hours. And it's also important for us because as we input this information, then we can put that on our website so voters can track where their ballot is in the system. They can log on to our website and see, oh, I see they've processed my application. My ballot's on its way in the mail. And then when they return the ballot through the mail, they can track to see that it's been received by the board.
You mentioned the application, Sherry, and generally just take people like, I want to vote, Sherry. I'm calling you up right now to ask you, hey, Sherry, how do I vote? Tell me how to do that.
Yes. Well, first I will ask if you have access to the internet and a printer, because that'll be your quickest way of receiving an application. So if you have access, you can log onto our website, download the application. Ohio law does not allow electronic submission of those applications, so we can't accept them by email or fax. So the voter does have to print the application, fill it out, sign it, and mail it to the Board of Elections. If the voter does not have access to a printer, then we will mail them an application.
Okay.
We also have in 15 different Kroger stores throughout the county, they have accepted applications. So we have a stock of the applications there that people can call the board to find which Kroger stores have them, or, log onto our website for a listing.
And we're now actually, as we record here on April the 10th, Friday, the Inquirer is also going to run that application in the print paper as well, as I understand.
That is great. That is great. We appreciate that.
So you fill out this application, you mail it in, and then the Board of Elections mails you then back your ballot, you fill it out, and then you mail that back.
That's correct. That's how the process works. I do want to note, we are receiving applications where a voter is forgetting to check the box and let us know which type of ballot they are requesting. This is a primary election, so voters need to tell us if they wish to receive a Democratic ballot, a Republican ballot, or an issues-only ballot.
Yeah.
And for those voters living in the first congressional, they also have the option of choosing a Libertarian ballot. So voters do need to let us know which type of ballot they wish to receive.
Gotcha. If they haven't done that, are you reaching out to them to say?
Yes, we're reaching out to them in a multiple of ways. We will send them a letter. We're also, if they've provided us with a phone number or email address, we're also calling those voters and emailing those voters.
Do you, and so what is the deadline then that you have to absolutely have that postmark, your ballot postmarked by, to have your vote counted?
Sure. There's a couple of deadlines I'd like to talk about. One is the deadline to have to turn in your application to the Board of Elections. So the application deadline is at noon on Saturday, April 25th. So we have to receive your application by that day and time in order to mail the ballot to you. For returning your ballot, as long as the voter returns the ballot by 7:30 p.m. on April 28th, it will be included in the unofficial count election night on April 28th, just like we would in any other election.
Now, can you drop that off in person?
You can, absolutely.
The application and the ballot itself.
Absolutely. We have a drive-up Dropbox. So to drop off an application or a ballot, voter doesn't even need to get out of their car. Drive up Dropbox. We also, for the most part, our office is closed to the public, but there's a small vestibule area outside of our lobby, and we've set up a self-serve station. So voters can come into our vestibule area 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. There's applications sitting right there. They can fill it out, put it in a drop box that's inside that area, and it's complete with hand sanitizer as well.
but to be clear, that's all they can do in that vestibule area. In terms, like, it's not like you can just go ahead and get your ballot right there and cast it and be done.
That's correct. That's correct. You cannot pick up your ballot here. You have to drop off your application, and then we mail you the ballot.
When they mail it back, do they need to get their own postage?
No. When they mail the ballot back, and this legislation that the General Assembly adopted, it included funds to pay for the postage of the return of the ballot. So when the voter returns the application, they are required to put a stamp to return the application. But when they return the ballot, that postage is prepaid by the Board of Elections.
How will voters be tracked? You know, we always say, hey, there's this amount of voters were voted out of this precinct, or, you know, on election night. And, you know, we always look at trends and see, okay, well, this candidate lost because this candidate didn't get this section of the county or this chunk of the city. Or will all, when it's all said and done and the results are released, will the public know by precinct how people voted?
They will know how people voted by precinct. Those voters who vote absentee, they're still voting from their precinct. You know, their ballot is still associated with their precinct, just as if they would have appeared in person on election day. So we will be able to have results showing how each candidate did in each precinct, the results of each precinct's results. What'll be a little different election night is that for those of us who follow what precincts have reported throughout the night, because I do believe we will be releasing numerous reports throughout the night. We are permitted to tabulate after 7:30 p.m. on April 28th. So 7:31 p.m. we'll hit the tabulation button. We'll release the results at that time. Somewhere, I think it'll probably be posted to the website around 7:45 by 8, no later than 8 p.m.
Okay.
But we'll have late arriving ballots that we'll have to add to that. So I do believe it'll be a periodic reporting through the night, which is what we're sort of all accustomed to. The difference is that you're not going to see, 30% of the precincts reporting, 50% now we're you won't see that, because the ballots don't come in from voters by precinct like they do on election day. You know, we receive that entire precinct's ballots all at one time when we have in-person voting. When they're coming in through the mail, it's not in that same order. So we're still trying to work out some ways of reporting so that the public will have a general idea of, okay, is this all of the ballots? Is this only 10% of the ballots? You know, so we're still trying to work the logistics of that out for the election night reporting.
It does change in a way, because, like, I think it's pretty granular to talk about the precincts and, like, counting it by that. But for anyone who's really an election watcher, like, they do look at that, because they're like, okay, Bond Hill's not in yet. Well, they'll vote this way for this election, or the West Side, they're not really in yet. And like, and the precincts, there are people who really can, you know, really make predictions based on which precincts are in so far and which are not.
That's absolutely correct, Terry.
I think that's something we can, I think.
But we do, you know, we're, again, trying to be as transparent as we can. We are trying to develop some mechanism that we would be able, with each report, to give somewhat of an idea of this is the total ballots that we've received, and this is, you know, maybe 70% or. But that's a little bit of a challenge for this election, so we're still working out those details.
Sherry, what was the?
I'm sorry, Jason.
Oh, go ahead.
What was the number like before the change? How many people early voted?
Sure. So up until through March 16th, 22,000 people had voted by mail, and 14,000 people had voted early in person. So we were a little over 36,000.
Was that up or down from what people had predicted?
That was it was up in comparison to the past two presidential primary elections. So turnout was up so far in comparison to 2016 and 2012. And I can tell you that through today, since March 17th, through this morning, we had received 50,000 requests for absentee ballots.
What are your turnout predictions at this point? Up or down, or is this making it easier at this point?
You know, it's really tough to call. I think we'll all find out on April 28th because, or closer to the 28th, there might be those that do not participate because it's an all-male election, or you might have even more voters that participate because they find it easier to vote from the comfort of their home. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
What was the absolute drop dead deadline that you have to have your ballot in the mail by?
April 27th. So ballots have to be, yes, they have to be postmarked by April 27th or delivered to the Board of Elections by 7:30 p.m. on April 28th.
Okay. So then therefore there's still going to be some that hadn't been counted. So if you mail it on April 27th, it may not get there to the 29th or 30th. And so that will be counted then in the
In the official count, correct.
Yeah.
And that's typical of every election.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
Yep. Right. So ballots that are received by 7:30 p.m. on election day are included in what's called the unofficial count election night. Ballots that are received up until the 10th day after election day, in this case, that'll be May 8th, as long as they're postmarked by April 27th, they're counted in the official count that occurs about 2 to 3 weeks after election day.
Gotcha. Let's talk about, you know, quote, election day. And there are some folks who are allowed to actually come and cast their ballot without actually dropping off, but they can actually cast their ballot on that day. Can you talk about that?
That's correct. There is in-person voting at the Board of Elections only on April 28th for a very limited number of voters. And those are voters who fall into one or two categories. It's either voters who do not have an address in which they can receive mail. So that would be basically homeless voters, mm-hmm. and voters who have a qualifying disability. And those would be voters who typically appear at their polling place on election day and use our disabled access unit, which is a ballot marking device that allows the voter who would normally need assistance from election officials to cast their ballot independently. So that option is still available for those voters. It's just at the Board of Elections only from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m.
How do you ensure that someone's not going to come in there and, you know, say they're disabled or say they're homeless, but they're really not? Like, what mechanisms are in place to ensure that people aren't going to abuse this?
Right. Well, it's difficult. You know, I would hope that people would understand that those resources are for voters that fall into one of those two categories. And if you don't fall into one of those two categories, leave those resources for those who do. And vote by mail.
I do feel like it's going to be a very difficult situation if people just show up not understanding, because it'll be past time to request a mail-in ballot.
Right.
Like actually turning people away.
I understand that and have that same concern. I think all boards do across the state. You know, we're just asking for people to do what's right and follow the law. And if they don't fall into one of those two categories, vote by mail. Again, leave those resources for those who need them. You know, we will be practicing the social distancing here. You know, and keeping even those in line 6 feet apart and enforcing all of those guidelines that we can.
And not to project or anything like that, but obviously you have to be prepared for anything. Let's say, will there be law enforcement on hand? Will there be, is your staff how is your staff prepared to handle anything, like that, where people just normal, regular people just show up in droves to vote because they think this is election day, and then they're told no.
Right.
Is there anything in place to try to make sure that?
well, a few things. We do have law enforcement scheduled to be here, but that's more to control the traffic.
Yeah.
You know, in my experience in the 16 years I've been working in elections, we've never had to involve law enforcement at the Board of Elections for anything. And I hope that, we really, the same way when people do come and vote early at the Board of Elections during normal times, even when there's long lines, I'm always so impressed by the voters because they just peacefully exercise their right to vote. They're courteous with each other and to our staff. And, I'm hoping that, really hoping that that just transpires over to April 28th too, and that they will cast their ballot by mail, which is what the General Assembly has set up for voters in Ohio for this election, and again leave those resources to those who really need them. We do have law enforcement here, but that's to help control traffic.
Yeah.
We do expect a lot of people coming to drop off their ballots and use our drive-up drop box. So our plans for law enforcement is to control the traffic.
Yeah. I just meant more, I didn't mean I don't think there would be any kind of anything crazy, violence. And I just more so if there's enough people who show up, who don't fall under the categories of people who can vote on actual cast their vote on election day, how is that going to be handled if people then are turned away essentially? Can they actually be given can they fill out the application on the spot and then be given their mail-in ballot and then fill that out on the spot and then drop it back in?
The application for mail-in ballot must be received by April 25th at noon on that Saturday. Yeah, so that deadline will have already passed.
Gotcha, yes. Sherry Coolidge?
So, what are your calls coming in looking like? Are people worried about this? Are people calling just to ask for, how does this work? And you're telling everybody on the phone the same information we're talking about now? Or is anyone calling with some worries?
Most of the calls that we're receiving now are for individuals who are requesting an application. That's the vast majority of our calls. And we actually did set up a call center to handle this. And we're running at 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we're also holding Saturday hours for the call center as well from 8 a.m. To noon. So the majority of the calls is people calling to ask how to get an absentee application. We also are receiving calls from voters who are just checking to see if we received their application and is their ballot on the way. And so we're addressing those calls.
And a lighthearted question. And we have a serious question too about the fall, but a lighthearted question. Was this a real thing? I feel like you've seen on social. Are you sending out stickers that say I voted by mail? Was that a real thing or somebody made that up?
It's a real thing. We have sent I Voted by Mail stickers out for several years now to voters who vote by mail. Unfortunately, this election, those that ballots we were able to process in-house received those stickers. We also have to outsource the printing of some of this because of the high volume we're receiving, and the machine that's used for that is unable to insert the stickers. So we won't be able to get one of those stickers to everyone.
Okay. I saw it and I was like, well, another change. The stickers are important to people.
I have one other question, Sherry Poland, and that is, now, I think this week you started hearing out of Washington, hey, is the November election going to be different now as well? Have there been conversations back here at home in Hamilton County and in Ohio about the possibility of a only vote by mail or some kind of a, changed election in terms of how we vote coming up in November?
I have not heard of any serious talk of switching to an all-male election in November, anything official.
Okay.
But I can, you know, tell you what, even if we still, if we do still have in-person voting in November, I do think more people may decide to vote by mail. Mm-hmm. And so we are definitely sort of collecting the data as we go through this sort of spontaneous all-male election right now to help us better prepare for November in case we would go to an all vote by mail election, or just more people decide to you know, vote by that mechanism. So we're definitely, you know, as we are going through this, also preparing for November.
If it is to be a vote by mail for some reason, I mean, I do think that obviously information is coming in day by day. I mean, the models change constantly of, you know, how things are going. How much advance notice would you want?
That's interesting. I actually just had a phone call with our director of the Ohio Association of Election Officials earlier this morning, and we were discussing that. And, you know, I kind of threw out a date of July 4th. You know, I think I would like to know by that time in order to properly prepare. You know, I don't think this is something we can wait until Labor Day. You know, we've already assigned our poll workers on Labor Day. That's usually when we mail out their packets. And it just the volume of supplies and, you know, just thinking of ballot stocks and envelopes and all of that, and just all of the logistics of a presidential election by mail, you know, I believe we would have to know by July 4th.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know, we did things last minute because they had to be done last minute. Like, things were changing, obviously, minute by minute in those days, as hard as it was. But hopefully by July, we have some sort of handle on how things are going.
That's my hope.
Sherry Poland, great stuff. Thanks for taking time to answer all these questions in these, you know, unprecedented times in this unprecedented election. Just really, really appreciate all this great information.
Sure. I appreciate you having me on so that we can help get this information out to the public.
Thanks, Sherry, and all the best as leading up to April 28th.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Sherry Poland. Great stuff there, informative. I'll tell you what, she does a great job, and that entire team over at the Board of Elections, they're just top-notch and true pros. And I'm just speaking from my own standpoint. Anytime I ever ask them for documents or data, I mean, that team is just right on top of it.
No, transparent. As much as, like, people do talk about election fraud and everything, they could not be more transparent. They have, you know, all kind of meetings and where it's discussed, open to the public. And two, like, the idea that it moved, the Board of Election moved to Norwood, a place where there's parking that's directly in the middle of the county, has really made it a lot more accessible, too.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a great facility. It's easy in, easy out. Like you said, free parking, ample parking, versus the old Board of Elections. Sherry, I remember you and I going down there for a Souls to the Polls early voting event. It was on a Sunday. Obviously, I think Souls to the Polls on a Sunday, and it was for the 2016 election. And the lines and the crowd and just how you were able, I mean, you had people lined up through city streets, and it was just, you know, it was cool to see, but just the logistics of the whole thing were not good, and the building was old. But no, it's so great that they have that facility in Norwood now. Let's shift gears to what we call the fun segment of our episode. And Sherry, you have a new thing that you just did and was fun. And we are always open to talking about new, what do we call it, quarantine festivities or events.
I have to say, I wish we were talking about going out and doing things. I miss those days. but I did, you know, kind of the things you see on social media. We hosted
pandemic dinner party via Zoom. It was a lot of fun. Basically, I created a very small group, because the smaller the group, the more you can talk. Yeah, and I'm sure everyone else has learned with Zoom meetings, they don't work with a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I sent out a dinner menu. Everyone made the same thing. And then we all got, you know, dressed up as much as we would for a dinner party, which is to say, you know, not wearing day jammas.
Yep.
And at a certain time, and I created the meeting, and then I sent out the code. And so there was like charcuterie boards and chicken marsala and just like a really good conversation. And like, I did it up so much that literally Jack kind of came out of his bedroom and is like, "Are you two going out?" And I was like, "We're going out, but we are not."
Yeah.
And it just was some sense of normalcy of like the idea of getting ready to go out on a Saturday night. And not, I think it has been very difficult where the days run together. And Kevin Necessary had that amazing cartoon last week.
Yes. Of
just a person standing on a very large April calendar. And
yeah,
it's hard to know what the days are. They blend together. Our work is 24/7, of course. Like, and so there's things that do happen on the weekends too. And I did on that day feel very normal. And I thought that it was helpful in the larger scheme of things.
So what did you set your laptop up on your dinner table? And
I did.
That's what everyone else did, or?
I did. And okay. Alex and I sat, you know, next to each other at like the corner of the table.
Yeah.
We set the table. We got out the good dishes and the good glasses.
I love it.
And then you do have to sit, of course, like right next to each other to be seen on the camera.
Yeah.
And then the computer had its own little place.
And you guys are eating dinner there as you're talking to your friends.
Yes. And like,
and they're doing the same thing.
And we did. And I started it out with like a very specific everyone did not know each other. Everyone tangentially knew each other. And people definitely didn't know necessarily like wives or husbands as well. Just like a real dinner party. And so we kind of started out by just introducing ourselves and what we do. And then we also talked about what was the last normal thing that we did.
Yeah.
And we talked about, the thing that we're most, and at the end, like the thing we're most looking forward to going back to.
Yeah. What'd you
and
say?
So, my last normal thing, I think, was I did go to Florida.
That's right.
Kind of right before this, and it was.
Yeah, right before, yep.
The news cycle was the election and the presidential race, and it was Super Tuesday week, and like. That's the news was full of all of that. And I flew back in an airport. We sat next to each other and on a plane next to each other. And then so that was a Sunday. Then a Sunday later, the bars and restaurants closed. And that whole week was just kind of leading up to, you know, things were closing pretty like day by day.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, the last normal thing.
I mean, really, life changed almost literally overnight.
It really did. And the idea of like being in the house so much and preparing all your meals in the house. I mean, everything's different. And I do, we've talked a lot since, you know, we're friends and not just coworkers.
Yeah.
Our moods go in ways. Like it's hard sometimes. And then other times I feel totally normal because I'm having talking to all my friends at a dinner party.
Yeah.
And trying to get outside every day is a good thing. I noticed last week. A nice weather helps that, of course. But
yes, it does.
It's hard. And I miss like normal things that I never thought that I would miss because who thought they would go away?
I know. I'm totally just, I keep saying this. I feel like America generally has like another couple weeks of this left in them. And then it's going to be, people are going to be so antsy to just get back to their lives. I don't know what that looks like, to be honest, but I mean, I don't think it's like this massive revolt or anything like that, but I just think that you're going to start seeing just people just complain about it so much on social media, and obviously being sensitive to those folks who are dealing with this virus. But yeah, I just think that Americans are we're used to our freedom, and we're used to going out to restaurants and bars and going to the office, and I just feel like we only have a few more weeks left in us of patience, I guess is the right thing to say. But whatever the leaders say we have to do, we got to do it.
No, and the governor yesterday, so it was yesterday, Thursday the 9th.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of new news yesterday, but he really spent a lot of time in wine with DeWine. Or as I called it last week, dust with DeWine. He cleaned during the listening to the press conferences. But, you know, he really was like, be patient and like, we have to keep doing this or it'll all be for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all.
So it's hard and it goes in waves, and anyone who's listening feel like they know, but this could be a good reminder of like, we know it's hard too.
I just keep telling myself I desperately want a college football season. So I'm going to continue to do my part and staying at home and staying away from people. So,
or to be able to do all the rescheduled things, right? Like to do a derby in the fall, or like, you know, things have been rescheduled and not necessarily directly canceled. And so that is why we're doing this now. And so we can do the things that we love again.
Then we can have a red season, hopefully, or an FC Cincinnati season, whatever that looks like. If it's only a month or two long, then so be it. I think that we would clamor at and love the idea of just having some kind of a season for both of those sports or those teams.
Right. Things can look different, but it'll be nice to have them still.
Absolutely. Well, Cher, it was great to have you back. Another fun episode. Thanks so much to everyone who are listening, sticking with us during this time of staying at home. If there's anything you'd like, you know, to bring up to us, questions, comments, concerns, complaints, whatever, email us, jwilliams@inquirer.com, jwilliams@inquirer.com, and scoolidge@inquirer.com, scoolidge@inquirer.com. Hit us up on Twitter at Sharon Coolidge and at J Williams Cincy with a Y. And so with that, we will catch you next week.